something from God, I should kneel out in the street and ask him so he knows I'm serious? I hadn't a reply for that. The good thing about complete darkness is you can lie there quietly and let the other person rethink the smart-alecky thing they've just said. With any luck, they'll begin to regret it, or possibly they'll believe you have a magnificent rejoinder in mind, but are too well adjusted to use it. I just thought, Swede said, that if Dad could pray and have something like that happen, then maybe we wouldn't have to worry about finding a gas station open tomorrow. You want him to pray the tank full? Well, how's it so different? It seemed like she never asked a question to which I had an answer. I don't even know if he prayed, Swede. Maybe it just happened. I don't know if he ever prays for them or if they just come. A brief cold moment, and then she said, What do you mean if they come? What other ones are you talking about? Well, like when I was born. You know what happened. You don't call that a miracle? Oh, yeah. You know how it is. You grow up with a story all your life. It can transmute into something you neither question nor particularly value. It's why we have such bad luck learning from mistakes. She said, I thought you meant other times. Of course I'd meant other times, and it now seemed like some wretched betrayal not to say so. He walked a long ways one time on nothing but air, I told her. It was probably the wrong place to start. Strange, isn't it, that we'd never had such a conversation before? Strange that I could see my father step out supported on the void and not go tell my sister? Or see him fired by his boss, only to reach forth and heal the undeserving puke, or watch a pot of soup multiplied to satisfy the most impressive of appetites and keep all my wonderment to myself? Why didn't you tell me? Swede asked. I didn't know. Why does any witness keep shut about something? You could have noticed some of this yourself, don't you think? Like the saddle? I can't believe you didn't notice that. The saddle was a clincher of sorts for Swede. While I told the event to the best of my recall, she climbed over me, out of the bunk, and crossed the trailer in the dark, hands feeling out front, until she found it there, a-spraddle the sawhorse. There was silence while her fingers located the place high on the cantle. For a half-second, my mind swarmed with dread that I'd dreamed or imagined the healing of the leather, that she'd find it still torn and believe forever in my cruelty. Instead, there came a hazy sigh. She whispered, I've been sitting on it just like normal. Cold as it was, she stood by that saddle a long while. It's been this part folks disbelieve. Not that the saddle was made whole, but that Swede had gone all this time without seeing it. Odd on the face of it, I know. But we're fearful people, the best of us. We see a newborn moth unwrapping itself and announce, Look, children, a miracle. But let an irreversible wound be knit back to seamlessness, we won't even see it, though we look at it every day. In the morning, it was a brisk 19 degrees according to the roofing co-op thermometer Dad had rubber-banded to the bed rail. In case you were starting to think miracles were a convenience of mathematical dependability, we'd run out of propane during the wee hours, which also meant a cold breakfast of dry cereal and bread. The milk was a frozen cardboard cube. Outside, the wind still pushed and grieved round the trailer, and we stumbled about inside, snugging it down with an urgent quiet in our hearts, a fear strangled by cold and hurry. Dad's head still ached, but he regained himself enough to stretch and shadowbox and chide us toward warmth. I remember moving through a sort of stupefaction, kneeling atop the stove, putting the coffee pot away in its high cupboard. My numb fingers hit a stack of cups, and down they all came to explode around my knees. At this, Swede began inexplicably to weep. I remember how slowly this appeared to happen, the detachment I felt from the descending cups, the clamor of breakage coming almost before they hit, as if sound outruns sight in the glaciated mind. I remember the noise seeming to delaminate and rearrange into a distorted assemblage of crying and bursting ice. A few moments more, and I'd have cried too from pure confusion. Except then Dad began to sing. Not like Caruso or anything, He was generally uncomfortable in the same room with his own raised voice. He sang lightly, almost offhandedly, and what he sang was,
"Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He has loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on."
This lovely warlike anthem Dad sang with increasing good humor straight to its end, steadying me with his hands, picking up wicked white shards.
"I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps,"
dropping the shards in a paper sack.
"They have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps."
Sweeping up the glistening dust, my mind brightening the while, and Swede's grief fading to a series of exclamatory sniffs.
"His truth is marching on."
Rarely have I felt such claim to a song. Certainly it was our battle hymn as much as the Republic's. All that morning we drove cold. We drove from town to town, all of them shut to us if we'd thought to buy gas or propane, wind-sacked, immobile towns with Presbyterian and Lutherans and secure Methodists standing around their church doors, assured laymen, all of them, with no need for fuel, while we move slowly through, wondering moment to moment when the last spoonful of gas would drain from the tank and leave us to wait on whomever might come by. Between towns we drove west, between stubbled fields, the stubble sticking up through what poor snow had blown and dried and shrunk across the plains. In no place did we see a state trooper, in no place a gas station lit from within. We drove for hours. That we didn't run dry may indeed have been the miracle Swede wanted. Nearing midday, we began seeing what looked like mountains shorn off at the roots. Swede pointed them out as buttes or mesas and said it meant we were in the west for certain, a fact also evident in the presence of beef cattle and oil derricks, often in the same pasture. Swede said something about Teddy Roosevelt, her hero among all presidents, and how he had ranch not far from here, and how the winters had been so bad in those years that ranchers sometimes lost 1,000 head in a single storm. She had read a book about this, as you might expect. It was called Ranch Life and the Hunting Trail, and was written by Mr. Roosevelt himself. Swede said he was not only the best cowboy ever to live in the White House, but the best writer also. He was a friend to Owen Wister, to Frederick Remington. He credited the hardness of ranching in North Dakota with his recovery from asthma and numerous other griefs. This was good information, but not new to me. You couldn't be Swede's brother very long and not know the profits of the strenuous life. Just at the moment, I was too cold to care. I shrugged deeper into my army woolens and watched our entrance into Mesa country. Here there was barely snow at all, though leaden cloud banks brooded overhead. The mesas followed one another down the horizon, north to south. We saw fences more and more rarely. The derricks worked alone in the matted grasslands. Once I asked Dad whether we were in Montana yet, but he said no. North Dakota was a big state. Sometime afternoon, the Plymouth began to miss. Not like your small cars, bless their dainty hiccups. When the Plymouth missed, the whole car seized backward, cousin to a bucking horse. You had to hold your head against whiplash. Dad pulled over, and Swede laid the road atlas across her knees and judged us close to a town called Grassy Butte.
"We'll stay there," Dad said. "Grassy Butte. I wonder if there's a garage. Say, you two, let's get something warm there."
And you know, in that moment I loved the old Plymouth and its cranky ticker, for something warm was just ahead, and we were heading for it. Already I could imagine a cafe, that rare pleasure, with cocoa in a thick white cup. And the cafe would be so warm, we'd all take our coats off. Honestly, Swede and I were so pleased we got giddy, poking each other as the wagon bucked along. Before reaching Grassy Butte, though, Dad spied a farmhouse with two pumps in the driveway and a red and white sign out front saying Dale's Oil Company. Another sign said closed, but a light was on in the house, and Dad pulled in, saying,
"I believe we might prevail on Dale. What do you think?"
prevail on Dale, I repeated to Swede. To make a sail, she added. And if we fail, we'll wail on Dale, till he needs braille. Will you guys desist? Dad asked. No one answered his knock, though we could hear voices inside. He knocked again, and this time the voices got louder, and the door opened, and a woman was standing there with a baby goat in her arms, just a little goat suckling at a bottle she held. She looked surprised at the three of us. It's Sunday, she said. We're shut. Is Dale here? Dad inquired. Sir, the woman informed him. Dale's not been here since November. It's hard to look back and describe Roxanna to you as she was when we first saw her. Big-boned, yes, but not in the cushiony sense people often mean. Tall, dirt-road blonde hair in a back-swung braid, wind-burned in the face. She looked like some woman from a polar dog sled expedition recounted in the Geographic. She looked, I would say, built to last. My sympathies, Dad said. Appreciated, but gratuitous, the woman replied, and Swede would have loved her forever for that phrase alone. Dale left November 25th. Every day since has been Thanksgiving. Well, what does a person say to that? I watched Dad look down at his feet, smiling, one hand rubbing the back of his neck. The woman stood there holding her goat, which was yanking single-mindedly at the bottle. It let go once to bleat and bump her chest with its blunt nose. Dad looked up. Ma'am, I sure hope you'll sell us some gas. I know you'd rather not on a Sunday. At this moment, a better observer than me would have seen some acquiescence in the woman's eyes, some raising of the gate. I saw nothing of the kind, but Dad must have, for when she abruptly shut the door, he stayed right where he was. Swede started to talk, but he shushed her. The wind snapped our coats around our legs, and now it carried a few gnats of ice. From far inside the house, we heard the goat's voice. Then the door opened again, and the woman came out in a parka with the fur up around her ears and walked fast ahead of us to the pumps. Check your oil, she said, while the tank filled. It's fine, Dad said. Swede and I had climbed back in the Plymouth under our blankets. You mind if I don't do your windshield? The woman said. What's your name, if I may ask? Roxanna. The pump clicked off, and she finessed it a little. You should change the sign to Roxanna's oil, Dad said. When it warms up, I'll do that. Roxanna's eyelashes and her furry hood were studded with ice bits, which, strangely enough, had a softening effect on her appearance. I think you'd do more business. It's a more attractive name, if I may say it. You should have seen Swede during all this, sitting straight up, head tilted, a more transfixed rubbernecker you never saw. $5.50, Roxanna said. Dad said, I don't guess you have any propane? Roxanna Cawley did have propane, in a bulk tank behind the house. We waited inside while she filled our cylinder. There was a glass counter with boxes of Butterfinger and Three Musketeers, alongside some Dutch Master cigars and a clipped display of Dr. Grabo's pipes. There was a gumball machine, a framed print of the Wild Bunch, the famous one where Butch sits happily on the far right, nearest the bullet holes, and there were two goats, Kid and Nanny, stabled in a bathroom behind the counter. Seeing us gawk, Roxanna opened the door to show the satisfied mother standing on a hummock of straw. The kid curled asleep by a clawfoot tub. There was a basin of water and a crockery jar. It wasn't as dirty as you'd expect. The Billy lived in the barn out back. Roxanna said he didn't deserve to be in the house. He made smells only he himself seemed to enjoy, and anyhow, he'd be rejoined by his family as soon as the kid, Beth, got stronger. What's wrong with Beth? Swede asked. Born blind. Randy kept pushing her away from Mama. He wouldn't let her eat, so I moved them in here. Dad said, Who? Randy, the Billy. Ruffian, Swede said. Thug. Miscreant. Roxanna smiled at Swede, who no doubt had been exerting herself toward that exact result. Knave, Roxanna said. Scapegrace, my sister replied. Oh, she was beaming. I had to take a step back and look at her. No show-off by nature, Swede seemed actually leaning forward toward this Roxana Cawley. I believe you could have dropped a plumb line and proved it.
"Brigand," she sang out,
at which Dad, in extreme befuddlement, herded us out of the door, saying something about finding a place for the night. Turning back to Roxana, he asked whether Grassy Butte had a garage or a motel.
"Garage is closed. The owner's drunk. The highway motel is right by the water tower."
Dad held up a hand in thanks and shut the door. We hadn't made it back to the car when we heard it open again. Roxana Cawley was standing there looking thistly. Did I mention her knuckles before? This woman had worked.
"Or, if you like," she said, "I have a couple of rooms."
The skin bag. It may surprise you, after the goats in the bathroom, that Roxana Cawley set a pleasant and even cultivated table. Against the grassy barrens, she managed to coax forth string beans and acorn squash and to put them up in quantities reaching to late January, though of course everything lasted longer with old Dale gone. She also had sweet corn of a white variety I'd never seen before, a strain she liked for its tenderness and because it froze well right on the cob. Did you ever sit down to white-cobbed corn, freshened with butter and salt, snow meantime beating the windows on the coldest evening of a cold new year? Faced with such fare, I couldn't even begrudge Roxana her advocacy of pickled beets, a bowl of which she set down with restrained pride and expectation. Fortunately, Dad proved fond of beets. You never know. We dined beneath a bronzed corona in which remained but one good bulb. We ate roasted chicken, raised out back the previous summer, and tender potatoes brought by train from the Red River Valley, and gravy stirred up from the cracklings. I suppose it was a meal intended to impress, though you don't think of a woman like Roxana worrying about how her hospitality comes off. She hadn't seemed at all ashamed about the goats. But she went to a lot of trouble for us, who were, after all, just one small family paying a few dollars for a night's room and board. During the meal, I saw Dad lean back in his chair and smile over and over again, an expression that grieved me somehow. Swede looked often at the windows, and I knew she was growing the storm in her mind, abetting it until the world should be slowed and the roads stopped, and us buried at some happy length in the warmth and contentment of this house. And what things we learned around that table, what lessons we had in the ways of independence, for Roxana Cawley had started life on a ranch in a valley of northern Montana, a ranch, like many of its neighbors, given up in the Dust Bowl years and sold for the unpaid taxes. While moving into town, she'd ridden with her father in the rented truck and watched a maddened, ribby steer stagger across the road. The steer was blind with disease, and Mr. Cawley evaded it with an artful swerve, but Mrs. Cawley, following in their Chevrolet, struck it broadside and was killed in that moment. Roxana, 7 and waiting in the cab, first believed it was her mother screaming, then that it was her father bellowing in grief, but actually it was the steer, which lived a few more minutes. Thus did Roxana grow up motherless, just as we were doing. Thus, by necessity, did she learn from her father the principles of business. Having failed at ranching, he borrowed from an uncle to purchase a clapboard theater on the main street of Lawrence, Montana. The previous owner had closed years before, having carelessly screened newsreel footage taken during the Pancho Villa troubles near the Mexican border. The jumpy newsreel displayed a line of dark-skinned peasants falling before a firing squad, citizens Mr. Villa considered to be of faltering loyalty. People of Lawrence were unprepared for such realities played out before them. Ladies swooned in their seats, husbands began a commotion. A high-placed council of indignants resolved that motion pictures had no business in the community. The local newspaper called it small loss. Therefore, Mr. Cawley's resurrection of the movie house was viewed as a risk, even decades later. Roxana remembered the care her father practiced in choosing films. he got most of Lawrence on his side with selections like Tarzan the Fearless and Tarzan Escapes. Johnny Weissmuller, Mr. Cawley informed young Roxana, was a man who could be counted on. Maureen O'Sullivan, too. Despite all the swimming she did with Tarzan, wives didn't mind their husbands watching Maureen O'Sullivan. Marlena Dietrich would have been another matter. Swede wondered if running a theater had often put Roxana in the proximity of movie stars. Roxana replied not many, but once after a showing of Kitty Foyle, her father turned up the lights and there sat Dalton Trumbo right in the audience. I asked who Dalton Trumbo was and learned he'd written the film. You'll laugh, but I'd never known films were actually written. Weren't they just actors up there talking? However, Roxana's father, whom she called Daddy, seized the attention of the departing crowd and introduced Dalton Trumbo, the great screenwriter. It got in the paper, a superb moment for Mr. Cawley, though it went hard for him later when Dalton got jailed. Had he robbed a bank or shot someone, there might have been forgiveness, but he got jailed for liking communism, which was a disgrace. Mr. Cawley had to take down the photo of himself and Dalton shaking hands in front of the marquee. It had hung in the lobby for years. Swede looked disappointed at this, because after all, who was Dalton Trumbo? It was only much later we learned he'd also written Spartacus, and by then gladiators had lost some of their shine, at least for me. But Roxana hated to let Swede down and said that once, talking of movie stars, Lee Van Cleef had showed up. Keep in mind, Van Cleef was still several years from his famous Badman roles opposite Mr. Eastwood. In fact, Mr. Cawley almost didn't know him, but had screened The Big Combo just a few weeks before. Van Cleef wasn't threatening in person, and as he was vacationing at a mountain cabin, seemed relaxed and content. He came for a showing of Tarzan's Savage Fury. After the movie, Mr. Cawley invited Van Cleef for dinner. Roxana remembered he wore a lavender shirt and a string tie and didn't think much of Lex Barker. As Tarzan's went, he was no Johnny Weissmuller. To this bit of talk, Dad added nothing but leaned back in a ticking-covered chair with his hands clasped behind his neck and his legs crossed as though at home. You could see he knew zero about Spartacus or the great screenwriter Trumbo or, for that matter, Lee Van Cleef, and you could see that his ignorance in these matters worried him not at all. Roxana Cawley was talking to us in a warm fashion we couldn't have guessed when we pulled in for gas. To Dad, so long without his wife, the particular formula of meal, woman, and conversation must have seemed like a favorite hymn remembered. I'm ashamed to recall thinking it was too bad Roxana Cawley was not lovely. I recall believing if she were only beautiful, she would somehow come to spend the balance of her life entertaining us in just this way, wrapping us in just this sort of comfort. My selfishness should no longer surprise you. Rather, the surprise might be that I thought of Dad at all, for it came to me that he was regularly alone after Swede and I went to bed at night, that he would one day be alone when we'd gone away. I watched Dad lean back, shut-eyed, in his chair, looking tired and pleased. We were warm, finally, and I rose to the window, where hard snow was spatting against the glass. "Reuben," Dad said, "how's the breathing?" "It's okay." Boy, I wished he hadn't mentioned it in front of Roxana. "Sounds a little ropey," he said. "I'm tired. Can I go to bed now?" I asked, aware Swede would view this as betrayal. "Of course. I'll be up soon, too. Go on, you two." I dreamed a devilish little man came and stole my breath. He stepped through the door with a skin bag strung limp over his shoulder and with dispassionate efficiency crouched back and slugged me in the stomach. Such an incredulous exhale, and so complete. Not a wisp of air remained. In that agonizing vacuum, I rolled my eyes upward and beheld the stranger tying up the bag with a leather thong. He had the opening squeezed shut in one fist and was throwing half hitches around it and yanking them tight. Now the skin bag was stretched and seamed. It was barrel-sized and taut as a blimp. Inside it was all my breath. The little man crouched again and looked at me closely. He was a pale one, a horror. Years later I would describe him to Swede and she would point him out to me, or his close cousin, in a book containing the works of Francisco Goya. When he straightened and went out the door with the taut bag on his shoulder, I saw that my breath was gone. anyone would panic. I thrashed and lurched and arched my back. On waking, I saw Dad kneeling beside me, holding my upper arms. I heard Swede crying distantly. Someone I couldn't see was thumping my back. I'd never felt such thumps. They were like car wrecks. But I got a little breath back, and with each painful thump, a little more. Confused, still afraid of the man with the skin bag, I tried to tear loose. In my perplexity, I thought it might be he who was socking my back. You don't emerge from these episodes thinking clearly. I managed to turn enough to glimpse Roxana Cawley in a flannel nightgown, hammering my corporeal self with the strictest resolve. It was a convincing sight. In fact, I felt quite rightly convinced I would live through the night. Dad continued to hold me in place. It was a joyous bruising that bit by bit knocked glue from my lungs. I pictured it coming away in gobs. You need to understand, Roxana was hitting me with the flat of her hands, not her fists. But even so, it felt like Sonny Liston was back there dealing it out. I'll bet she stayed with it 20 minutes. She was panting hard when she stopped. She sat beside me on the bed while Dad asked the usual questions. Yes, I was better. Yes, I was still wheezy. Yes, I thought steam might help. Roxana asked if she should go heat some water, and Dad said to put some baking soda in it and a little white vinegar if she had it. Before leaving, she bent and put her cheek to mine. Her hair was in a single thick braid, and moist coils of it had come free. They clung to my face as she pulled away. Next morning, all geography lay snowbound. Roxana's gas pump stood hip-deep. The road was an untried guess. Maybe 2 feet of snow had fallen, or maybe 6. You couldn't say. The wind had whipped it into dunes and cliffs. It was a badlands of snow. Swede's bed was empty. I hollered for her even while realizing the whole house sounded empty. Crossing the hall into Dad's room, I heard muffled scrapings and ran to the window. Sure enough, all 3 of them were out back. The sun was out so hard on the snow I could barely look. It was like we lived on the sun. Dad and Roxana were clearing a wide path to the barn. They were just finishing. Now Roxana and Swede were heaving at the big square barn door, trying to slide it open. Wait! I yelled. I ran to my room, hooked my pants and shirt, ran back to the window where I could watch them while I dressed. Wait for me! I banged on the glass, but they couldn't hear. I shouted again. Wait up! What were they doing out there in new snow without me? What a rotten deal. Then, surprise, I had to lean quick on the windowsill. All that yelling had used up my air. It wasn't like earlier with the skin bag, but the truth is I had to sit down. I was sweatier than I'd ever got taking down Mr. Layton's corn crib, and here I hadn't even got my pants on. Outside, I heard the barn door screel open, and Swede's outcry of wonder and pleasure, and Roxana laughing. I tell you, no one ever felt sorrier for their sorry lot than I for mine there in that empty house. I crawled back in bed under the weight of the sun and joy in adventure happening outdoors, and I thought dangerous things to myself. Back to mine came every hurt I'd endured for my defect, every awaited thing I'd missed. It seemed that I'd been left alone here by the callousness of my family, that should the man with the skin bag return, I might not fight so hard next time, that this house was so empty even God was not inside it. He was out there with the others, having fun. Late in the morning, Swede came in red-cheeked with the news that we would stay at Roxana's another night.
Dad walked out on the road. There's drifts up to his chest. Roxana says she never saw this much snow at once in her whole life. She says a couple of years ago it snowed a foot, and it took the county 2 days to plow the roads. For 1 foot, Reuben, and we got 4 or 5.
It was plain nothing could have pleased her more, nor me under other conditions. But I'd lain the morning in a sump of self-pity, and all I could see of Swede were her blazing, oxygenated cheeks, and all I could hear of her was speech gusting forth without constraint. "We're not going to find Davy sitting around here," I told her.
"Well, we don't have a choice. We couldn't get out if we tried."
Swede was wearing a hat of Roxana's, a fur hat with a narrow brim. Snow was stuck to it and turning to water. She'd wear it all day if she could.
Reuben, you've got to see that barn. There's the billy goat and 6 sheep, one with a black nose and black ears, and a bunch of roosting chickens. We picked eggs, and there's a rope in the hayloft. I swung around like Tarzan.
I said, you tell me what good it does staying here. Tell me one way it helps Davy.
She glared. You don't care about Davy. You're mad on account I went out to the barn. Who cares about the barn? Tell me one way.
Of all facial expressions, which is the worst to have aimed at you? Wouldn't you agree it's disgust?
You fake, she said. Laying there all sorry for yourself. You weren't thinking about Davy. You were thinking about poor Widow Whoopin.
So dead center was this that I leapt up and tackled her at the waist and landed half on top of her on the hardwood floor. A consumptive effort and strategic mistake. We scuffed around a little, she getting me twice in the jaw, fist, then elbow, before the energy leaked out of my muscles. She wiggled away and stood over me, and I was a gasping ruin.
I win, she hollered. Ha, look here.
She took a gigantic, wrathful, chest-filling breath.
Look what I can do.
She blew out the breath and snatched another. She did frantic jumping jacks. She ran in place.
See, I could do this all day. I could do it all year, all my life.
I couldn't speak. I rolled my eyes up at her like the betrayed steer at slaughter. I could hear my heart, boy, blacksmithing away in there.
I win, Swede shouted. Come on, Rube, say uncle.
I shut my eyes and by main strength hauled in air and said uncle.
Uncle, she demanded. What's that I hear?
Uncle.
She squatted down and looked in my face. I drew back instinctively. She couldn't have known, but this was exactly what the spooky fellow in my dream had done. Anyway, I didn't want to look at Swede. It's one thing to be sick of your own infirmities, and another to understand that the people you love most are sick of them also. You are very near then to being friendless in this world. Swede said,
Reuben, please,
I whispered. She got hold of my shoulders and made me look at her.
What's the matter with your lips, Reuben?
I gathered enough air for a sentence.
You went outside without me,
which set her off sobbing. She wilted down on the floor next to me. It was hard to fathom after such a fight. She put her arms around my neck, too, which was gratifying, but when it is like breaking cement with a hammer just to breathe, a tight hug isn't helpful, so I had to shrug her off. We lay there quite some time, a very woebegone set of penitents. At last, by lying still and thinking about a brightly lit room made entirely of ice, I was able to retrieve basic respiration. I sat up and leaned against the wall. Swede pulled herself over and leaned also. She took my hand and held it while confessing all sorts of things, chiefly related to piggishness, but also the surprising fact that she actually had forgotten about Davy, just for a little while.
I like being here, she said, with Roxana. Don't you like her, Reuben? Do you really want to leave?
I like her a lot.
We really couldn't go today. Too much snow. How come Dad started the car then?
I heard it out there, idling poorly, sounding broke. We parked the trailer in the barn. Roxana thought of it.
It's just a huge barn, Reuben. You have to see.
I didn't see it right away, but this was certainly the work of the Lord, the work of providence for you timid ones. It was a cup running over. Because don't you think the old state police were ever more interested in us since we'd vanished from pursuit? And wasn't it fortunate how the blizzard struck before any state cruisers happened past Dale's Oil? And where else could we have landed, I might ask, that would offer not only gas on Sunday, but cheap rooms and warm meals and a hiding place for the Airstream?
I took that baby goat for a walk this morning, Swede said, all around the house. She's so smart. She followed me all around.
Swede,
you pretty soon get used to her weird eyes. Where are we going to go? I mean, when we do leave.
She looked so blank, I knew leaving was way off at the end of things for her. I said, aren't we going to get arrested as soon as we get back on the road?
Say, that's true. That's right, she crowed.
I guess we better lay low a few days. Reuben, grabbing my arm, now we're fugitives too.
She was so thrilled I feared she might tear off downstairs and tell Roxanna about it. So I hushed her and reminded her how Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry had sworn silence in the matter of Injun Joe, and how running and hiding from the law was a privilege few kids ever had, and how we ought not blow it by bragging to someone we just met.
"Don't you trust Roxanna?" Swede whispered.
"Well, sure I do, but we just got here yesterday."
Swede nodded. "Okay, then let's sign in blood, like Tom and Huckleberry did. We'll cut our fingers and swear an appalling oath."
"Oh, for Pete's sake, Swede." She was already up rummaging for paper, came back with a strip of brown grocery sack.
"Get out your knife."
I had a cast-off scout of Davy's. The big blade was only knuckle long, having been snapped off trying to pry something. I swiped it cautiously.
"Swede, it's really dull." We'll use the awl."
"The awl?
No, Swede."
"I'd hold innumerable leather belts with that awl. It was blunt as a baby tooth. Also corroded."
"We'll get sick," I told her.
"We'll get lockjaw and have to go to the hospital, and then we won't be fugitives anymore." So we stuck with just the appalling oath. I've forgotten the exact parlance, but it was a rare and lofty oath, studded with illustrious and disused old words such as treachery and banishment and leprous. Roxanna was correct about the county snowplows. They weren't up to the job. Days opened and filled with work and talk and closed early. My lungs relaxed. I was allowed into the barn and taught to candle eggs. Swede climbed the loft and pitched down hay for the sheep. Following these modest chores, we cinched on scarves and went walking atop snowdrifts so hard they stayed trackless. We walked out above the road and looked down the white horizon. We were good and stuck and dangerously happy. Late in the fifth day, we saw what looked like jets of smoke spurting from the ground in the east. We put back our hoods expecting the chuffs and growls of plow trucks, but they were still too far for sound. Next morning, Roxanna and Swede cleaned out the goat pen in the bathroom back of the cash register while I investigated the pictures on the office walls. "What's this one of the town?" Roxanna poked her head out of the bathroom.
"Main Street of Lawrence? That's Dad's theater on the right. The Empress. See the marquee?"
Somehow, when Roxanna had told about her father's theater, I'd pictured something more conspicuous. Hadn't it drawn notables Lee Van Cleef and Mr. Trumbo? But the marquee of the Empress was nothing but a flat storefront sign across which lay Captain's Courageous in tilty letters. A toilet roared, startling the goats, yet Roxanna was wise. If you're going to stable critters inside a house, you can't do better than right by a toilet.
"How come you've got this of the Wild Bunch here?"
It was Cassidy and the rest posing in new suits. You've seen it, the one with the bullet holes.
"My great uncle spent some time with Cassidy," Roxanna called back.
Whatever Swede had in hand dropped to the floor. It didn't make a very nice sound.
"Your uncle knew Butch Cassidy?"
"Great uncle. They were friends," Roxanna said. "He's not in the picture, though. So you see, they weren't that close."
A revelation of this nature might have rendered Swede paralytic until the whole story was told. But Roxanna said,
"No, you don't. You said you'd help. Let's keep at it."
So Swede scraped and moiled with a renewed sense of enterprise, no doubt to grease along any emergent history. Roxanna's great-uncle had been a gunsmith and doctor, a canny occupational blend for a young man in Casper, Wyoming, at the end of the 19th century. Taken to visit him by her father, Roxanna remembered a kitchen table spread always with bits of firearm, trigger assemblies, firing pins, bolts grooved silver for want of oil. She remembered his mounted vices, one large, one delicate, and his magnifying lens like a jeweler's fixed to the frame of his glasses. He had a workshop in the basement, but preferred the kitchen. A lifelong bachelor, he baked himself cinnamon rolls almost every morning, setting the dough to rise before going to bed. When you stepped in his door, Roxanna remembered, you smelled pastry and coffee and oil swab steel. Sweet asked, a trace impatiently,
how the great-uncle knew Mr. Cassidy. The answer was, same way he knew all sorts of other people. You couldn't ever visit Uncle Howard without shooing away a man in a suit. They were salesmen from the Remington and Winchester and Savage companies. Or they were medical men come inquiring after his particular advice in the treatment of gunshot wounds. Running into Uncle Howard's kitchen, Roxanna had once banged into the knees of a man wearing a white shirt and black vest and a watch fob belly slung, as if from the foregone century. The man had helped her up, tipped his hat. He was a Pinkerton detective and offered to fingerprint Roxanna to illustrate his craft, but Howard chased him away. Howard didn't believe a person should be printed on a whim. He was an old man by this time and told his receptive great-niece that Pinkertons were honorable as a rule, but from long habit he considered them to be on the other side of things from himself. This is how he met Mr. Cassidy. Arriving home from church on a lovely June Sunday, Howard had been surprised to find a boy propped spraddle-legged on his front step. That's how the great-uncle described him, as a boy. The boy was leaned back on one elbow, like any idler, and had a piece of chalk in his hand, and he was doodling with the chalk on the broad slab stone Howard used for stoop and entry. On seeing Howard, the boy sprang up. He took off his hat and tucked it under his arm. Coming down off the step with a warm smile and his hand out, so that Howard had the dreamlike perception of being welcomed to his own home by a stranger. The young man asked if Howard knew who he was. Nope. Disappointment rose in the young man's face. He had a parcel in his jacket and wondered if Howard might have a look. Howard pointed out it was the Lord's Day. The young man asked him just to look. If he was interested, the parcel could be left till a day the Lord hadn't claimed. In truth, Howard wasn't in the habit of honoring the Sabbath. He was more interested in honoring the pan of cinnamon rolls he'd set to rise just before leaving for church. But the young man was so engaging, Howard allowed him into the kitchen, where some cattleman's hopeless carbine lay dismembered on the table. The young man sat down and unstrung his oilcloth parcel. With great sadness, he lifted forth a smashed revolver. The barrel was long enough to seem ungainly and had been flattened and twisted at the base. The grips were walnut. One had been split clean and might be repaired, but the other was like a pulped apple. The cylinder had been knocked free and was the lone undamaged component. Howard looked at the young man, who was swallowing repeatedly in evident grief. He said a train had struck it, that he was doing some work near the tracks and must have dropped it, and a train came along and rolled right over it. Howard said it was the most heartbroken firearm he'd ever seen. No, he couldn't fix it. All the king's horses and all the king's men. The young man sat at Great Uncle Howard's table, looking down at his knees. It made Howard ache. The cinnamon rolls were just browning up, and he offered one to the youngster. The roll helped. Roxanna remembered her great-uncle's rolls. His special pride was the frosting. He ordered back east from confectioner's sugar, 50 pounds at a time, and he added melted butter and a potion of strong brew coffee and a dried vanilla bean ground fine with mortar and pestle. After several rolls, the young man's spirits lifted. He told Howard to call him Butch. He said the revolver meant a lot to him. He'd ordered it for its long barrel because he was a poor shot and wished to correct this deficiency. He had a friend, Harry, who could walk out at dusk and spook up a dove and drill it in flight, right-handed or left. It was important to Butch that Harry respect him, as the two were working together. Moved by Butch's earnestness, Great Uncle Howard assured him the revolver was an unfixable mess, but offered to sell Butch a gun from his own armory. It was an 1860 Army he'd taken in trade from a retired Union captain. The captain had carried it through Antietam and half-dozen other situations, and had kept it in trim throughout. Howard liked its action, but not its dinged barrel, and had refitted it with one from a brass-framed Buffalo revolver, circa 1855. Butch looked it over and aimed down its barrel, which similarly had that ungainly length. The modification had been cleanly done, and Butch was interested, but strapped. He waged negotiations, upon which he was allowed to leave Howard's kitchen with the gun at half its value, the rest to be delivered upon arrival of Butch's next pay, which Butch affirmed was coming along soon. By the time Dad stamped in, bathed in dirty oil and bits of straw, we'd learned that Butch Cassidy had indeed paid off the revolver, that Great Uncle Howard had liked the young man's company enough to close shop occasionally and dabble in outlawry, and that he'd once had the strange experience of shooting an unruly trainman in the thigh, then removing the bullet 4 hours later at his town practice, having not even changed his clothes. I thought it was odd, the trainman not recognizing him and raising a stink, but Swede pointed out this sort of thing happened all the time. How many times did Zorro gallop magnificently out of town, everyone watching, then show up 5 minutes later as Diego, still breathing hard? And no one ever figured that out. Dad said, "Listen, can you hear the plows? They'll have us clear by dark." "Now that's auspicious," replied Roxana. "I'm out of milk. Also, the Plymouth is running better. Plugs were pretty much a mess." Swabbing noises from the bathroom. "So we'll be able to settle up, Roxana. We can leave tomorrow. Get out of your hair." I can hear him yet. "Settle up. Get out of your hair." In that dread moment, I realized some huge, imprecise, and desperate expectation had begun to form inside me. And so swiftly, I had no idea. Leave tomorrow? It left me empty and dumb. Swede, too. I've talked to her about it. She wanted to run out where Dad stood picking straw off his coat and hit him in the stomach. But clearly Roxana was thrown for no such loop, for she emerged upbeat from the bathroom, hair kerchiefed back like Aunt Jemima's, goat muck thumb swiped across one cheek, forearms crossed under rolled sleeves. The word majestic comes to mind. She smiled brightly at Dad, saying, "Are you in a hurry to leave, Mr. Land?" None of us, of course, was in a hurry to leave. Surely I wasn't. The truth is, my short history contained no such person as Roxana Cawley. What must she have thought when Dad, yanking me up out of nightmare, held my shoulders and instructed her to pound my back? Yet she pounded as if not just mine, but both of our lives were reckoned by her strength. As for Swede, every sentence Roxana spoke presented her with something new to admire. A movie star had eaten at her table. Her great uncle had ridden with Butch Cassidy. Also, she employed words like auspicious while cleaning behind goats, a positive indication of dignity. Dad's reluctance to leave, so far as I know, had little to do with Roxana. It had more to do with Almighty God, who so far had issued no instructions about what to do next. And so we awaited some event or foretoken, a long line of which we could recount in our march toward Davy's reclamation, the divine befuddlement of the North Dakota State Patrol, August Schultz's inkling toward the Badlands, Mr. Lurvy's bequest, even Dad getting fired by the depraved Superintendent Holgren. Why, we'd never have left roofing otherwise. Yet here we sat at Roxana Cawley's in a most disturbing state of satisfaction. Every morning, Dad studied the scriptures. Every afternoon, we did Roxana's chores and were repaid by revelatory tales of her adventurous and profane and torchlit forebears. Nights, Swede and I dozed in the comforting far-off resonance of adult conversation. We did not eavesdrop. Sometimes we'd hear Dad deepen his inflection. He was a very good mimic, a talent he would not practice before his children. And then we'd hear Roxana laugh. She had a low, beautiful laugh. And hearing it, you could only wish you'd said the thing that brought it forth. Here's a strange fact. By the time Dad declared with such candid bad timing that we could get out of Roxana's hair, I'd begun waking in the mornings with the sensation that I'd been born in her house, that I was as native there as the painted wainscoting and the clothes tree beside my bed. In all, it was as pleasant a mirage as any I'd occupied. But eventually the plow did arrive. Against all yearnings, we wrapped in coats and scarves and stood on a snow ridge to watch its tortured passage. The depth of the drifts hid all but its topmost parts, so that what we observed was a headlit monster crushing through nightfall with the tip of its V-shaped scoop borne up before it like the prow of an ice-breaking ship. To make any way at all, the plow needed a running start. It would back off 50 yards or more, then clutch into low and come roaring ahead, all chains and smoke, casting up backlit clouds that made us gasp. The whole effort was so heroic, Dad grabbed Swede and put her on his shoulders as if at a parade. When the plow had at last gone by, it backed up once more, and the two men inside climbed out and stood on their running boards to wave and holler. And we whooped and jumped around in reply, because it was thrilling, no matter what was to happen next. It's not every day such liberators appear on your behalf, and we cheered them like Ulysses home from battle. Then Dad said, "Swede, Reuben, in you go. Get your things together. Go on now." And the great moment was over. Next morning, we'd have to leave. In fact, Dad seemed so determined to leave, I supposed he'd received orders from the Lord at last. Upstairs, I offered this idea to Swede. I only meant it as comfort. "Did he tell you anything?" She was crying mad, firing balled-up socks in her suitcase. Well, he hadn't, which Swede knew as well as I did.
"If God told him what to do next," she said, "how come nobody else heard it?"
"Come on, Swede. Nobody else heard it with Moses. Nobody else heard it with Daniel or Paul or Jonah."
"Jonah,"
she said in disgust, then lumping in clothes.
"If God told him what to do, how come he didn't tell us all?"
"Who, Dad or God?"
"Who cares? One of them ought to have mentioned it."
She stomped away to the bathroom and returned with her toothbrush and poked it in the suitcase, too. "Don't pack that yet. You'll want it in the morning," I told her, wincing then as she spun and threw the toothbrush at me. It missed. Though tantrums were not usual for Swede, I could see there was more where this came from. I said, "What if God told Dad where to find Davy? What if that's why we're leaving?" This, by the way, was the first mention of Davy between us since the morning after the blizzard. You might remember it caused a brawl then. Not now, though. Now it just made a quiet, in which Swede slitted her eyes and peeked into my heart of doubt.
"Okay, Reuben, is that what you think happened?"
"Well, it might have."
"Is it your true opinion God told Dad the whereabouts of Davy and we're going there in the morning?"
"No," I had to confess.
"Then shut up about it," she said.
Suitcases packed and rooms neatened and clothes set out for morning, we went downstairs to help with supper. It was our routine now, and a busy one, Roxana being a thorough cook. Generally, I was sent to retrieve wax beans or yams or an acorn squash from the webby cellar, while Swede sliced bread or laid out plates and glasses. We'd pour cider, mashed potatoes, sliced pickles. We did with conviction, devotion, all the things we'd done so gracelessly at home. Even as we tromped downstairs, we felt the anger between us lifting, for there was something in Roxana's kitchen that dispelled trouble. Usually. This time, though, she was standing at the counter with her back to us, standing in a dark wool dress, pulling tight across her shoulders. The kitchen was lit by one yellow bulb above the sink. Otherwise, the house was dark. The dark flowed in through every window, as if they'd all been shot out and the dark and cold were coming in. And I wondered where Dad was, for we needed him here.
"Roxana," said Swede.
"Children," Roxana replied, turning to us. Though her eyes glittered, she was not crying. In fact, she pulled a smile from somewhere. Her hair was roped back in a French braid, from which it was very winningly coming loose, and she held before her a picnic basket with a clasped lid. For heartening sights, nothing beats a well-packed picnic basket, one so full it creaks, one carried by a lady you would walk on tacks for. "Does all this make her sound beautiful to you?" Because she was. Oh, yes. Though she hadn't seemed so to me a week before. When she turned and faced us, I was confused at her beauty and could only scratch and look down at my shoe tops, as the dumbfounded have done through the centuries. Swede was wordless, too, though later in an epic fervor she would render into verse Roxana's moment of transfiguration. I like the phrase, which hasn't been thrown around that much since the High Renaissance, but truly I suppose that moment had been gaining on us, secretly, like a new piece of music played while you sleep. One day you hear it, a strange song, yet one you know by heart. Under the Gibbon Moon. You're maybe wondering about the picnic basket, though North Dakota, with its wide views and variegated grasslands, is a fine place to picnic. For most, this holds only in summer.
As Swede would later report in her short, scattershot, and extremely readable story, The Dakota Territory, as I recall it. Few westward travelers since the emergence of internal combustion have attempted picnics in the Badlands in January. Anyone who's been there understands why. But Roxana Cawley was exempt from assumption. She knew, and her neighbors knew, that when the land lies buried in the miseries of winter, and loose boards twist with the cold, and the air hangs glassy and absolute over the world, that is when the merriest of all picnics happen. Anyone can tell you these are the times you need a picnic most. And the fact is, if you were lucky enough to live in the North Dakota Badlands in 1963, you could load up and have one at will. We didn't know where she was taking us. Dad, driving, just followed her directions. We were a quiet troop. Swede was curled away from me, and I couldn't have spoken if asked, for my throat ached with coming departure and with the beauty I had perceived in Roxana. So upright and calm she appeared there in the front seat, and so graceful, and so separate from Dad. Had the scene been mine to write, she'd have scooted closer to him. She'd have reached for his hand. Were Dad's heart my tablet, I'd have taken it up and erased Davy's name. So terribly did I wish to stay. And had it been whispered to me that all roofing had burned to the last toothpick, so that we had no home to return to, I'd have rolled down the window and shouted thanks to heaven without a thought for Dr. Noakes or Bethany Orchard or anybody. We went round a bend, and Roxana suggested we park, a difficult trick because the road was so skinny. Dad eased to the right till doors and hubcaps scraped the hard snow wall left by the plow. We piled out left. The road was a trench with sides too high to see over. We had to climb onto the Plymouth, bumper, hood, roof, which was something to laugh about and made us all more comfortable. But it was cold up on the snow. The moon was what Swede called a gibbon moon, meaning not quite full, but oval like a monkey's head, and it showed us a white hillside up which Roxana led us, her wool dress whipping. I ran and took the basket from her, and she put her mittened hand on my shoulder, and so we climbed, topping the hill at last to look down at what seemed a garden of fire. Fire and rising steam and specks of light, the specks pooling and runneling, then blinking out to be replaced by others. The fire came from a split in the earth that had been opened and zigzagged away through the hills. Smoke and heat and sporadic low flames issued from this crack and from others branching outward. It was a fearful sight for young readers of Scripture, and Swede clutched my arm even as I looked at Roxana for reassurance. No, I didn't think it was the genuine hell. It was way too pretty. Yet Swede had read to me how the distinguished atheist Voltaire sat straight up on his deathbed moments before acquiring the farm, and with horror in his eyes described in journalistic particulars a geography of fire spouts and molten earth and dense smoke that moved in heaps along the ground. All in all, an account not far from the sight before us now. No doubt Voltaire had a moment or two of deep regret before departing into that country. I know I was nervous. But down we went, descending the hillside lit by orange snow, down into the lee of the hill where the wind couldn't reach. And the snow, as we walked, got softer and wetter, and now we could see that the specks of moving light were streams of snowmelt, and the streams pooling and grating down into the crack were what created the steam and made the air so warm and sociable the lower down we went. Roxana told us how generations ago lightning had sliced into an aged cottonwood whose roots ran across a vein of lignite. The vein was narrow and deep, and the fire settled into the coal and spread inchwise until here, 100 years later, it lay before us, a snaking, glowing web reaching away into the evening. It was only our good fortune, Roxana said, pulling her hood back from her face, that it had happened here, not in more populous country. For then it would be a famous attraction, like Hot Springs or Lourdes, where the multitudes of rich and feeble sat around in scalding mud with cotton up their noses. As it was, we were the only folks about. And though it might be zero and blowing a gale up on the hill, down here where the ground itself seemed coming unstitched, we had to undo our coat buttons and loosen our scarves. "Mr. Land, right here," Roxana said,
and Dad took a folded blanket off his shoulder and flung it across a flat rock by the flames. The rock was bare and dry, and for radiant warmth, it was like sitting on a rooftop. Before us, the crack was more than a yard across, and the fire pranced up out of it, a foot high. Did you ever burn coal? It makes a white gold flame with a clean cerulean core. We leaned back on the blanket and were too warm, to our joy and disbelief, even unbuttoned. Roxanna, Dad said, it's a miraculous place. I never saw better. He was sitting beside her. The firelight had restored his face to healthy color, and she, all French braided, scarf unslung, resembled an opportunity missed by Rembrandt. I looked at Swede and saw hope showing in her face and felt it in my own. Come on, Reuben, she said. Let's explore. So off we went, with not so much as a caution from Dad, for he was looking at Roxanna through what I fancied were new eyes, she having worked a fairy tale in bringing us to such a place. It was indeed miraculous. How else to describe a valley where in deepest winter steam plumes as if from a battlefield, where boulders crouch warm as artillery, where spreading fire wakes frozen salamanders with which to scare your sister. We ran all over that piece of ground. We forgot the picnic. We jumped over narrow places in the crack and dumped armloads of snow down it for the thrill of the hiss. Once, resting against a heated stone, we witnessed the ignition of a dead juniper, a lacy brown juniper, not 10 yards away. It gasped, incandesced, roared into flame, and departed forever. For a moment, Swede and I had the same thought, that things in this realm were subject to spontaneous combustion. Try that on for an idea to give you the crawling heebies. But running over, she peered down the hole where the tree had rooted itself. Below lay the vein of glowing lignite. The event we'd seen must have happened here 1,000 times before. Returning, we saw a covered pan jetting steam beside the fire, also a small Dutch oven set a bit farther back. Dad and Roxanna were talking lightly in the way adults do who've just shifted gears to accommodate children. An infuriating tone for kids attempting to sound the future. Though Swede pried skillfully, Roxanna was more than a match for her sidelong queries. We had to be content with the hearty smells from the pots and with noticing how Roxanna sat, her back against a boulder, cushioned by Dad's folded coat. Were there time for it, I'd hear describe the delicacies we later spooned up, the heavily salted beef stew with pearl onions, and, from the Dutch oven, a golden gingerbread sweetened with canned fruit, a caramely mixture Roxanna called brown bear in a cherry orchard. But time was short. Dad was gazing down valley with a flummoxed expression. "Is that Martin Andreessen?" he inquired, pointing at a man in a coat, picking his way toward us through the rocks. Roxanna said, "Who?" "Martin Andreessen," Dad replied. "Government man. Is that him, kids? I can't quite tell." The fellow was wearing a knee-length coat belted at the waist, and he was stepping carefully alongside the fire vein.